I'm Johnny B. Good, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge this season of The Passage now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm editor Candace Gibson, joined by staff writer Jane McGrath.
Hey there.
Jane, when you think of ancient Egypt, what comes to mind?
Mummies.
Mummies?
Yeah.
Very nice. Yeah. I think of pyramids and Cleopatra with her crazy black eyeliner. And I guess everyone wore black eyeliner. And it wasn't so crazy. I think it actually helped deflect the sun, or it served some sort of very practical purpose. It wasn't just cosmetic.
Oh, okay.
I'm wearing mine today to look cool and super goth.
Not to deflect the sun.
Not to deflect the sun. It's, you know, it's kind of wintry and hazy outside today.
True.
The point being that all that we think about ancient Egypt and all of the Egyptian lore that we know and everything we know about mummies and pharaohs and Tut and Cleopatra and Ramses, we take it for granted, I think. But there was a really long period of time that no one really knew what ancient Egypt was all about. Like,
yeah,
they could see these things with their eyes, but they were mysteries to them.
Yeah, and they knew this was a huge civilization, obviously, but we didn't really know the secrets of what happened during the time that it reigned and was so powerful, because the language was sort of forgotten, and so the inscriptions that were written about it could not be translated.
And language aside, it was almost like the fascination we have today with Mars and outer space and imagining that there may be people out there.
It's a good analogy.
It's popular culture to us because there's no scientific or historical basis. And that's how Egypt was. It was very much a subject of popular culture. And while that may strike you as funny if you're sitting in school today maybe and you got a 30-minute lecture about one of the pharaohs, imagine that back during the time that Napoleon was in power in France, people dabbled in Egypt. People collected parts of Egypt.
And they would buy, like, collectors' items from Egypt themselves, and, like, the Egyptians who didn't quite know what they're worth, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that we should mention, too, is that not even the Egyptians knew what their culture was about. It was all just fun and games, really, that you could go into these pyramids and you could find gold, or you could find mummies, or you could find artifacts and pawn it off and make some change. And that all changed once Napoleon invaded Egypt.
That's right.
That's so funny to me that Egypt and France have such a strong tie as far as deciphering their history, but that's kind of how it went.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's pretty cool, actually, to look at what Napoleon did when he was trying to get power over the strategic position where Egypt was. He gathered this, he took his soldiers, but he also took a troop of academics, basically, scientists, chemists, even zoologists, and he called them up and he's like, this is a super secret mission, and just say that you're doing this for the good of France, and we're gonna, you know, study the culture and see what's going on. And I would just love it if, like, the president called me up today and was like, Jane, we need you for a secret academic mission, and we need you to come to this mysterious land with this, that has this mysterious civilization, and find out what it's all about.
It must have been amazing.
Yeah.
And Napoleon was nothing if not a shrewd leader. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't just plan to invade Egypt. He planned a very thorough infiltration. So this group of academics, it was called the Institute of Egypt, they set up camp alongside the soldiers. And unfortunately, things went a little bad military-wise.
Yeah.
And the French were essentially cut off. All their ships were destroyed. They had no way out. And they were sort of stranded in Egypt for about 18 years.
Yeah, it's true. It's interesting because when Napoleon landed with his troops and stuff, he was successful for a little while. He captured Alexandria. He won the Battle of the Pyramids. But then, sort of by accident, this British general or admiral, I should say, Horatio Nelson, saw his ships off the coast. And they didn't have Napoleon in it, but he destroyed the ships themselves, so they were stranded there. Napoleon and his troops.
And there's a lot that you could accomplish in 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they really did. They ended up writing a multi-volume work all about Egypt. But before that ever happened, they had to build reinforcements. They had to build forts. They had to build strongholds.
Yeah.
And when the soldiers were at work, they were tearing down walls of an old temple, I think,
mm-hmm.
and starting to erect a new fort in its place. And a soldier stumbled across this shiny piece of black basalt, and it had all of these inscriptions in it, and there were three distinct types of inscriptions. And he mm-hmm. thought, I don't know what this is, but it looks important.
That's right, yeah.
He took it over to the scholars, which was really handy, and they couldn't quite tell what it was either for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But they called this piece of basalt the Rosetta Stone because it was found in the town of Rosetta.
Yeah.
And it wasn't huge, but it wasn't small either. It was sort of about the size of maybe a small coffee table, and mm-hmm. it was pretty heavy because it was stone, maybe like a medium-sized LCD television or something like that, if you think about it in those terms.
So they thought they knew it was really important, even though they couldn't quite figure out why. But so they wanted to hang on to it, first and foremost for Napoleon. But when the English obviously had their hold over France in that area, the English were really adamant that they hand it over.
Yeah, so by the Treaty of Capitulation, they had to mm-hmm. give it over to the British. But the French were pretty quick thinking, so they made some copies of it, first of all, and that was
smart.
Really, really smart.
Mm-hmm.
So the British had the original Rosetta Stone. The French had copies of it, and both camps set to work trying to figure out what it was.
It was pretty hard. Like, when I learned about the Rosetta Stone back in school, I guess I just learned the basic facts that it was the key to figuring out hieroglyphics. But it's interesting to look at the history because it actually took them quite a while to actually figure out and crack the code.
It really did. And it had three different types of writing on it.
That's right. It had Greek, which was relatively well-known at the time by academics, and Demotic, which is sort of a subset of hieroglyphics, and hieroglyphics itself.
So these three different strata
mm-hmm.
of languages. And we know from the Greek, that was the easiest to interpret because, like you said, scholars didn't know Greek. And the Reverend Stephen Weston actually interpreted that in April 1802.
Mm-hmm.
We realize that the stone was dated from March 27th, 196 BC. What scholars later found out is that it was one in a series of stela, essentially, like a religious or governmental decree
mm-hmm.
written on stone. And these were very, very common in Egypt. It was almost like the Ten Commandments being on a tablet.
Mm-hmm.
This was what people did. I mean, the Egyptians later had papyrus, but for the time being, you know, they were putting their writing on stone.
Mm-hmm.
And there were so many that this one, the Rosetta Stone, really is not that significant in mm-hmm. the grand scheme of things.
The actual message on it is not that
riveting. The message on it is not that riveting. I think basically it talks about how the pharaoh is a good person, the pharaoh respects the gods, the pharaoh is humble, ergo, let's all honor the pharaoh.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the key to deciphering hieroglyphics that makes it so memorable today. So Here's what happened with hieroglyphics. Back when Egypt was its own entity and it didn't really have any other outside parties bothering it, it used the language of hieroglyphics, and this was a very spiritual and reverent sort of way of writing.
So, yeah, no, not everybody knew how to write hieroglyphics. Like, it was reserved to, like, the particular carvers, and it had a specific purpose. Like, it was either for religious writing or, like, governmental writing.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then they decided that they needed a more pedestrian language that everyone could use and everyone could write on.
Mm-hmm.
So then we have hieratic.
Yeah, and this was easier, right, to write on, like, papyrus, you know, and it was smoother to, like, it was sort of like a cursive version.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
And the same process continued, and by then we have different parties coming into Egypt and different cultures influencing them. We have Demotic, which evolves next, and that's a simplification of hieratic, simplification of hieroglyphics. And then finally, when Christians start coming into Egypt and the culture and religion drastically change, we have Coptic.
Yeah, and this uses the Greek alphabet mostly, but then there are some things that the Greek alphabet had that the Egyptian language didn't, so they incorporated some sort of hieroglyphic-like characters in it.
Exactly. So the reason that the Rosetta Stone had three different languages on it is because they wanted to make sure everyone could read the stone.
Mm-hmm.
The decree was public for everyone. And like we said, not that interesting a decree, but very public nonetheless. So after Weston translated the Greek, the next step was trying to go ahead and do the Demotic, because that seemed the next easiest to do.
Right.
And there were two men who did that, relatively contemporary of one another, and that was Johann David Åkerblad and Antoine Sylvester de Sacy.
That's right. And these people sort of knew Coptic relatively well. Like, they had studied Coptic before, and so they had an easier time translating the Demotic.
Exactly. But hieroglyphics was a very persistent mystery, and one of the reasons for that was that a 5th century scholar, a Greek scholar named Hierapolo, put out the idea that hieroglyphics were characters representative of symbols or allegories. And so, I mean, think about it. If someone told you that little white dogs were representative of all things evil, it would be really, really hard for you to shake the idea that little white dogs were bad. Like, no matter how you tried to change your ideology and your way of thinking, you would always have in the back of your mind, stay away from little white dogs. And that's what scholars were encountering as they went through this interpretation process, was that hieroglyphics translated to symbols and allegories.
So they took this Hierapolo's idea and ran with it, and they just assumed this was right, that one character represents an idea, basically. And it's not, they assumed that it was not like English, for instance, which had an alphabet where letters have a sound attached to them.
But that's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And no one figured that out until years later.
Mm-hmm.
So running with this idea that hieroglyphics represent symbols, but Thomas Young came along in 1814, and he discovered the cartouche, which was essentially a loop around a group of hieroglyphic letters.
Yeah.
And he realized that only proper names were the ones in a cartouche, because he was able to discern the name Ptolemy. And he knew that from, you know, the Ptolemaic rulers who had come in, and he knew that they would have, you know, somehow been signified and mentioned in a governmental decree.
Mm-hmm.
So that set the standard for looking for cartouches.
Yeah, and but he was still working on Hierapolo's hypothesis, so he couldn't really go much further than that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very limited. Well, along comes Champollion, and he knew from a very, very young age that he was destined for something great. And people knew what hieroglyphics were, and they knew that no one had mastered them. Like, it was very much a challenge that I think people aspired to.
And sort of a patriotic challenge, too, because, like you said, Thomas Young, he was actually British. And so he was fighting to translate the hieroglyphics first for England, you know. And Champollion was French, and because they found it, they really wanted to translate it first, too.
And he was a very, very serious scholar, almost like the Albert Einstein of France at this time. He was very withdrawn. He was sort of erratic in his behavior. He was considered sort of an unusual character. And even at birth, people said he looked like he was Egyptian because he had, you know, a darker skin tone, and his eyes were a little bit more yellowish looking. He didn't look like a Frenchman. And
so he was destined for this.
He was destined for this. And I think that there's some sort of legend that even a fortune teller came in during his childbirth and said he was going to do something really great having to do with Egypt. I don't know if that's true, but it's sort of fun to think about. So his whole life, he knew that he was going to master hieroglyphics. And even to the point that his older brother had had to care for him, essentially, because he wasn't feeding himself properly. Mm-hmm. He had no money. He could barely sustain his own life. And
well, that makes sense now, because I heard that he fainted when he actually translated the first thing.
Yes. He was malnourished, but his brother actually was able to keep him out of military service. He said that Champollion was doing a greater service to his country by trying to crack hieroglyphics than he would in the military. And good thing, too, because I don't think he would have been a very good soldier. I think he would have been pretty unhappy in that post.
Yeah, and if he's a fainter, I don't think he'd last long.
No, not so much. So he's working off Thomas Young's cartouche, and he starts to see a couple of different hieroglyphic symbols that he is parsing out, and he comes up with the idea, well, what if each symbol relates to a sound, and he discovers the name Ramses using just a couple of figures filling in the letters.
And one of the first, his first clues was seeing this circle with a dot in the middle, and he was like, you know what, that could be the sun. It has, you know, he made this leap of faith that, you know, that maybe that's the sun, and he knew that in a related language that the sun, the word for sun was Ra. And so using the phonetic, like the sound of it, he was able to eventually find out that this name was Ramses.
And I think he saw two more characters that were very clearly meant to be S.
Yeah.
So he had R-A blank S blank S.
And he knew it was a proper name.
He knew it was a proper name. Who else would have been famous in Egypt at that time?
Yeah.
Ramses.
And so that was it, and he fainted.
Commenced fainting. There you go.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that after Champollion essentially translated that one name from hieroglyphics, this still was a very painstaking and laborious process people had to go through, and there were many, many things to be translated. But I think that brought about a lot of excitement because now Egypt and the field of Egyptology that sprang from it, it was a sanctified field in archaeology and history and science. It wasn't just a matter of popular culture. It was kind of sad for people who realized all of a sudden, oh my gosh, I've been selling priceless mummies and here's what they mean. And who knows who has it now? I think some of them were even shipped off to Europe, ground up, and mummified remains swallowed.
That's right, like in the medieval times.
Yeah, so all these artifacts were very far flung around the world, but now at last people knew what the history was.
And this, you know, like you said, it was both academic and sort of a fad in social areas too. And so people were like obsessed with the culture now, and there were fights with like the museum. Like obviously England had the Rosetta Stone, and they were also getting all the stuff that France had gotten in Egypt. And so there was this like academic fight. Sort of.
And even to this day, people still debate who the real victor is, France or England, because clearly Champollion was, you know, the Frenchman who ultimately discovered hieroglyphics and the key behind it with the sound corresponding to the word.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, Thomas Young, the Englishman, if he hadn't discovered the meaning of the cartouche, where would Champollion have been without that?
True.
So I think they debate back and forth today, and I think that the Rosetta Stone also went on display in France for a while for a celebration of its discovery, and there were rumors that the French were plotting to steal it. And even today, I think that Egypt is opening up a museum in the not-too-distant future, and they'd wanted to bring the Rosetta Stone home to display it.
That's right. I mean, it's understandable. Like you see England and France or whatever fighting over this, and you're like, hey, it's kind of ours.
Yeah. It came from Egypt.
They stole it from us.
But because it is so heavy and fragile and unwieldy, it would be very difficult to transport it. So I think that discussion is still in the works, and we shall see what happens. In the interim, you can find out more about ancient Egypt, modern Egypt, ancient civilizations in general, and the Rosetta Stone on HowStuffWorks.com.
And you can also find out more about how encryption works at another HowStuffWorks podcast called Tech Stuff. You can find on iTunes today.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge this season of The Passage now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.